You are listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church, located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to westhill.net/donate.
Before I forget, remember that after service, we have some snacks and beverage in that room, and please stay around for a short time, a long time, whatever you choose. Thanks. We wish to acknowledge that we are on the territory of the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nations lands, which lands were previously occupied by the Seneca and Huron-Wendat First Nations. We call upon the federal government to eliminate the discrepancy in federal education funding for First Nations children being educated on reserves and those First Nations children being educated off reserves.
Grounded, Guided, Growing, A Time for Centering, from Scott Kearns.
I've mentioned this a couple of times. I just want to say it again in the sense of the word grounded. The first hymn, which some of you might have grown up with, This Is Our Wondrous World, you were stretching a bit to hit the high notes in the last verse. That was already three semitones lower than the hymn book key. I'm just telling you, I have already lowered it, and I only lowered it four, and I play it, and then I go up just a half tone for you to lift your spirits. And I saw you straining. It wasn't hard for me, of course. I'm just playing a different white key. But anyway, the idea of grounded when you don't feel grounded is one of the reasons I come back here each time, and or when I meet with you in conversation during the week, is to refresh that sense of the reality of this life in all of its variety, its ups, its downs, its challenges, its joys, the beauty of it, the terror of it, depending where you live, even right now, nature is terrifying you or filling you with joy. And so that's the reality of our life. And so in whatever situation we are, it's always the choice in this place. Again, just as a reminder, what would love do in this? I just heard something on the news. What would love do then? I just had a problem at work. What would love do now? It's that momentum of asking that question when we face that reality of life. And I also come here to share wisdom with you because you have wisdom I don't, and maybe I have some you don't, and we share that together and we learn. So just as I play softly under, just this is a chance to center ourselves back to those big pillars of reality and that commitment, that recommitment. Some of us grew up with recommitment services where people would come to the front and recommit. Those in the Salvation Army would remember the mercy seat. You would come and recommit, realize where you had failed. And we don't do that ceremonially, but in a centering time, it's getting yourself back to that. This is what I want to be about. And I will seek the wisdom for doing that.
The reading this morning comes from an ancient Chinese philosopher named Zhuangzi. He was one of the earliest thinkers to contribute to the philosophy that has become known as Daojia, or School of the Way. This is from thousands of years ago, and it is in a complex style. It's mythical, poetic, narrative, humorous, indirect, and polysemic. So listen carefully. It's different, so if you just sort of let the words come to you. A beam or pillar can be used to batter down a city wall, but it is no good for stopping up a little hole. This refers to a difference in function. Thoroughbreds like Shiji or Hualu could gallop 1,000 li in one day. But when it came to catching rats, they were no match for the wildcat or the weasel. This refers to a difference in skill. The horned owl catches fleas at night and can spot a tip of the hair. But when daylight comes, no matter how wide it opens its eyes, it cannot see a mound or a hill. This refers to a difference in nature. Now, do you say that you are going to make right your master and do away with wrong? Or make order your master and do away with disorder? If you do, then you have not understood the principle of heaven and earth or the nature of the 10,000 things. This is like saying that you are going to make heaven your master and do away with earth, or make yin your master and do away with yang. Obviously, it's impossible.
Focused Moments from Greta Vosper.
The focus moment picks up on the not dualities, but the complementary realities of Zhuangzi's writing, and trying to pick up on those things that are reality, that describe reality, descriptive things, and then those things that invite us to look at morality and the complementary nature of that. Thick or thin? Front or back? Slow or fast? Beginning or end? Solid or fluid? Dark or light? Perspective circumscribes, limits, defines, and makes its choice. And all we bring to the decision is the prejudice of our neural pathways. Good or bad? Forgive or forget? Hurt or heal? Build or destroy? Shelter or expose? Invite or ignore? Perspective circumscribes, limits, defines, would make its choice. All we bring to the decision is the prejudice of our neural pathways and our determination to live with love. Normally you see me come up here and I don't usually have notes, and looks like I'm just easily talking about what I've prepared for the Sunday, but it's because I've sat there during some time and I've read all my notes. I left all my notes at home today. So I'm trying to capture the essence of the thoughts that I had put together over the course of the week, and maybe we'll end up in the same place I thought we were going to end up, and maybe we'll end up someplace else. Well, it'll be an adventure. I wanted to look at some of the things that create those complementary balances, the yin and the yang, the things that can't exist one without the other, and explore a little bit about how we define what is good in the world. How do we decide what is good? I talk about a paradigm that has an understanding of a deity who is the source of all that is good, who is the agent through which good gets into the world, and who actually promises that good will out, whether or not it happens in our lives, or whether or not it's happening in some way that we don't understand, or whether it happens after our lives. That's the understanding of a divine supernatural interventionist being as that which defines what is good. And if we don't have a belief in that kind of being, then we have to reevaluate those things. What is the source of good in the world? And how does it get into the world? And what's the promise related to that? Like, is everything going to be good eventually? And we talk about how rather than assigning good to a divine being, we recognize that we assign good. We name what is good and what is bad. And we are actually the source of goodness getting into the world. Like it gets into the world through our hands, through our voices, through our actions. That's how good makes its way into the world. And then there is that ever-present lament that there is no promise that good will out. There is no promise that everything will work out in the end, that our pain will go away, that our relationships will be healed, that the world will finally get to the place where all of its inhabitants see one another and recognize dignity and worth and beauty, and that we work together in seamless harmony. There's no promise that that's going to happen. There's the potential, though, for us to help make that happen. There's the potential for good in any moment, in anything that we do. We can make good happen. But the question is, where do we find that and how do we figure that out? When, in the past, reality was, as Loyal Rue puts it, confused with morality, where the reality of a divine being was mixed up with the ideas of what was good in our heads, so that we had an easy definition of what was good. It was what was good according to that divine being, which, you know, if we got right down to it, even with the divine being in place, we still had figured out what was good for us as a community and sort of projected that onto the divine being so that we would be healthy, we would be whole, we would be safe, we could take care of each other, our communities would not be threatened. As I was doing the research for Amen, I learned about a group of people who lived, I think it was in sub-Saharan Africa, and they had fish. They mostly had a fish diet. And there was a fish that was totally, they weren't allowed to touch that fish. It was against their religious laws. It was a religious taboo to touch that fish. But in actual fact, that fish was a fish that was the only thing that if a certain illness hit that group of people, would actually be able to cure them from that illness. And so it seems that that taboo, which became projected onto a religious idea, had actually been put in place to save that group of people, to maintain their health, to care for them in very difficult times. So it's a modern day but ancient recognition of how we have done that in the past. Loyal Rue talks about the different natures of what religion is about, that it's about creating frameworks in a variety of different ways. And he says if we can figure out those frameworks and figure out how it works, then we can actually shift and change it and take what is important and take it forward. And that big thing that he thinks is the most important about religious is that confusing of reality with morality. So I wanted to talk today about how we figure out what is good. There's often an accusation that people who do not believe in God, and I'm sure you've read these and seen cartoons about them, people who do not believe in God don't know right from wrong, that they do only what is good for them, that they will compete with anyone else because they're taking these relativistic ideas of what's good, which means I can say what's good, and you can say what's good, and you can say what's good, and the fact that all three of us disagree doesn't matter. You just pursue what you want to pursue, and I'll pursue what I want to pursue, and the heck with everybody else. That sort of relativistic understanding of what is good and what is not is taken from a very personal perspective rather than an absolute understanding of morality, which says, God says, this is good, and you have to do it. And everyone in the world is expected to live according to that same understanding of what is good. But the idea of what is good is a slippery idea, because along that continuum, there's what's good for one and what's good for another, and there's that space in between, and it's very, very difficult. A colleague reminded me that today is actually Reformation Sunday. It's a time when there's a celebration recognizing that the Reformation, the time when the Protestant Church broke away from the Catholic Church, took place, and all of the good things that proceeded from that. But there was really never, there was no plan for a reformation. You do know that, right? There was really no plan to split from Mother Church. Luther was just really kind of ticked at this requirement that was sent down from the Pope that everybody was to sell indulgences as a way to make some more money to build St. Peter's. And Luther was really rather annoyed about that because he was now being required to take money from people in his diocese or whatever it was called at that point in time who had no money. But he did so by telling them, and this is from the Pope, you've got to tell them that if you don't pay the money, your loved one's going straight to hell. It's going to stay there. You're never going to get out, right? But if you paid the money, that person would get out of hell. Well, now who wouldn't pay the money? I mean, seriously, if I don't give them this last dollar that I have, can I think of Scott in hell for eternity? No. Even on my bad days, no. So I give him the last dollar. You're so relieved. You're welcome. I know you do the same for me, honey. So Luther was sent a letter back saying, hello? Like, you're not serious about this. You have more money than anyone in the world. You have so many riches, and you're sitting on those. Build the silly church yourself and leave my people alone. And he just expressed some annoyance with that and then started arguing that indulgences, this idea of taking people's money in order to sell them something in the afterlife, that was corrupt, that it wasn't, there was a misinterpretation. And he got into this great big argument with the church about what was right and what was wrong and how they were supposed to live and how they were supposed to lead and how they were supposed to care for people. And he got into this argument. I've seen that happening recently. It's happened down through the history of Christianity, most especially in the Baptist church. They're known for their schisms where, you know, someone in a congregation will say, wait a minute, this is not the way it says we're supposed to do this. And they'll split off and there'll be another congregation. They do it. They've done it often. After the Protestant Reformation, we split into a pile of denominations. We've been doing that ever since. Questioning the authority and trying to figure out how to do things right. But how do we figure that out? Do we look at the doctrine of a particular denomination that we happen to be in and try to find morality woven into that? It's not usually there. There's not a lot of morality in doctrinal statements. Doctrinal statements are about belief. They're not about how we're going to live. So we have to figure out how we're going to live, and we can't find that in the doctrinal statements. One of the problems, I think, is that Christianity, as many of you know because we've talked about this, Christianity in the 4th century shifted from that how we want to live to how we want to believe. And when West Hill started the process of trying to create a statement of faith, we went back to that time before belief. Because as soon as we sat around the tables in the lounge and started talking about what we wanted to put in a statement of faith, we realized we were doing that, drawing a line straight down through the congregation, maybe not in the middle, but off to one side. Someone would just say, well, it needs to say this because I believe that. And then someone would say, but wait a minute, I'm not sure that's true. And statements of faith since the 4th century have been about belief. They've been about identifying who's Christian by who believes what. And if you believed according to the Apostles' Creed or whatever was in vogue at the time, then you were in. And if you didn't believe in it, then you were out. Recently, the United Church of Canada, you know that when the United Church of Canada came into union, when they came together, the Congregationalists, the Methodists, and the Presbyterians, they came with very different statements of belief. Like, each of those denominations had very different ideas of what was right and what was wrong in terms of what they were supposed to believe. So cobbling together statements of belief from those three denominations was a tricky and challenging thing to do. They did it, and if you are having a hard time getting to sleep some night, you can read them. They're long, and they're heavy, and they say things like, you know, the finally impenitent shall be cast into eternal damnation. All of you who are members of the United Church, did you know that was part of your statements of doctrine? No. Well, it is. But those articles of faith, because those three denominations coming into union had different opinions on pieces of that. One of the Congregationalists, those were always the dissenters, they were always stirring up trouble. The dissenters, one of them said, you know, we can't all agree on those things the way they've been written. We can't agree on all of that. So we're going to have to figure out a way to get around it. Particularly the clergy who were having to preach, and they didn't want to suddenly have to start preaching a different theology than that what they had been ordained believing. So they got this thing called essential agreement put in, and you guys have heard about that recently because that's part of this review, or actually opposite of that. That's not part of this review is what makes it problematic. So clergy, if he was a Presbyterian clergyman coming in, he'd be able to continue to preach according to his Presbyterian beliefs. And if Wei had been she'd had to be in dissenter, so she was a Congregationalist coming in, she would be able to preach according to her beliefs. And if Greg was a Methodist, all of those Methodist things would still come out in his word on Sunday. So they were allowed to do that. And it worked really, really well. It actually created union. We wouldn't have had union if that Wei's denomination hadn't come up with that little idea of essential agreement. But it changed shortly after that. As soon as the first person was ordained by the United Church, that phrase really didn't have any meaning anymore. Because what it was really saying then was you only need to be in essential agreement with these doctrinal statements that we have. But what does that mean, being in essential agreement? So it came to recognize the sort of plasticity of beliefs, that you could say you want to cast the finally impenitent into eternal damnation, but if you really said, well, I think it's important that people who are not nice, that we acknowledge that and we tell them that. And they, you know, that could be essential agreement, I don't know, but you'd have to, it allowed for movement away from that. And when I was ordained, it's a committee who told me that I was in essential agreement. And so I could go and answer those questions of ordination affirmatively, even if I didn't literally believe them. So that was the thing. But I go through that just to say that in 1908, those Articles of Faith were written. They were made part of the founding documents of the United Church of Canada when they came together in 1925. Shortly after that, they started writing new statements of faith because they recognized that they were written before the Great War. The perspective had shifted and changed. People had changed. And so they had to be rewritten. So in the 1940s, they came out with another statement of faith that moved them along a little bit and again said, you know, this is just a statement for our time. We have to keep at this. This is going to evolve and change. And they were walking into the Second World War at that point in time, and it certainly did change. The understanding of good and evil and of a benevolent God, that was shattered during the Second World War. And so in the late 1960s, we came up with a little liturgical piece, which is known as the We Are Not Alone creed. And then in the early 2000s, we began the work of looking at another statement of faith and came out with a song of faith, called a song of faith because it's supposed to be understood metaphorically. Interesting that. But those things all diverged from the Articles of Faith. But even then, when someone was ordained, they needed to be in essential agreement with the Articles of Faith. So the church decided, you know, we can't do that. Those Articles of Faith, they're so archaic. Why don't we include these other ones? And a motion went to General Council, and they created a structure of authority with the Bible as the authoritative text of the United Church of Canada. And the Articles of Faith, timeline, Articles of Faith, Statements of Faith, Liturgical, New Creed, and Song of Faith as subordinate documents. And that really was what Luther was doing about the church. He was taking the authority of the church, and he was recognizing that that authority shouldn't be at the top. He said the Bible is the authority that judges all of that papal authority. And he made the word central to what they were doing. So the United Church seemed to do that, and the people who brought the motion forward, John Young, who's a professor at Queen's University and was one of the candidates for moderator this past year, he made the motion, and they were tickled pink that the idea of subordinate documents reflected what happened through the Reformation and brought us in line with other Reformation traditions. Just tickled pink about that. But I think they were miles from where we are. I think they were miles from where the United Church of Canada is. I think they were miles from where the United Church of Canada has been. Because the United Church of Canada, since 1925, has never had the Bible as its authority. Not over its statements of faith, not over its congregations, not over its ecclesial structure, not over the missions that take place and the partnerships that happen around the world. The Bible has never been the authority. It has always been subordinate. The Bible has always, in the United Church of Canada, the church that I grew up in and that I love and that I know and that I speak to and that I fight for, love has always been the authority. And the Bible has always been subordinate to love. It's been subordinate to love when women wanted to be ordained. It became subordinate to love when women were talking about control over their own bodies and having a conversation about whether or not they had the right to eliminate a life growing within their bodies. It became subordinate when ministers became divorced and would normally be kicked out of the pulpit because of that sad reality. In the most troubling and challenging and horrible time in their lives, they would lose their vocation too. And we recognize that love could not let us do that. So we made the Bible subordinate to love there. And then we made the Bible subordinate to love when it came to the ordination of gays and lesbians. Because, hello, I don't care what the Bible says about that. There's leaders here in our midst who have so much to offer that we have to acknowledge that. And love, with the Bible subordinate to love, we can do that. Now, the United Church kind of messed that up because they still thought the Bible was the authority. And so they went back and started parsing scripture texts and coming up with new understandings and redefinitions of terms. And, oh, didn't you know that meant that? And so they could say it was all about those texts, those terrible texts. They were all about hospitality. Who cares? The reality was it's a text that is subordinate to love. And the United Church has lived that out all its life. I met with a woman who was writing the chapter on God for Don Schweitzer's History of the United Church, and we were talking about the stickers we used to have when we were youth at church. They had those big Live Love stickers. Does anybody else remember those? Psychedelic 1960s Live Love stickers. We had them on everything. She found a Live Love sticker the other day and a few weeks ago and bought it and kept it, you know, because it reminded her of her youth. We were always about love. So making the Bible the authority in the United Church of Canada is an issue that I have with it. So what do we do faced with this biblical authority? And what do we do based with the fact that we actually have lived with love as our authority? What do we do in a world where more and more people have nothing to do with religion? What do we do? How do we speak about what is good? How do we find good between one thing and another? How do we define what one person thinks is good against what another person thinks is good when those are in conflict? How do we find our way forward? And this is where you come in. Because I don't think that isolated, we're able to figure this out. I don't think that alone, we can come up with an idea of what is good. I think that the brain takes what the stuff that comes into it and it attaches meaning and value to it and so says, oh, this is good. I had a conversation with Scott in the car on the way here that chocolate, because my brain releases serotonin when I eat chocolate, it thinks that chocolate has a moral value of good. You know, like I've worked that one out, right? In actual fact, it doesn't have any moral value. I have to decide myself and I have to label it that. And I can do that better if I have you doing that with me. I can figure out what makes me good if I have you helping me with that. If I have a conversation with you, I can figure out how close or how far away I need to be from a potential choice, from a decision that I am going to make, whether that's a decision that's going to help me bring about more beauty, more goodness, more love in this world, or whether it's something that might shut down a lot of who I am and not allow me to bring those things into the world. Without you, I don't figure that out. Without a place where we talk about things like, I was weeping again in the song Amen, because those words. You know, if we don't stand all together, then together we will surely fall. Like, if we don't find ways to live those values out in the world, then we will be cut short of the dream that we have for this world and what it could be. And so it's important that we keep creating communities, that we talk about what it is that we do, that we press the missions of our workplaces, the vision statements that are on the wall of the places that our loved ones are in residence, that we press all of those up against that authority of love and challenge them to live up to that. It's not, I said on a radio interview yesterday, the radio host said, you know, like, it's nothing for United Church to have an atheist minister. I mean, United Church is as kumbaya as they get. So I explained to him how love is the authority in the United Church and how the Bible is held accountable to love. And I talked to him about what that looked like. And I said, if you think that's kumbaya, you've got another thought coming. Because there's nothing harder in the world or in a personal life than trying to live out love. When you're angry, when you're frustrated, when you're living without things that you need, when you're poverty stricken, when you're part of a demographic that is completely excluded from rights, that doesn't have access to adequate public education, even if they get free post-secondary education. Come on. Like, how do we live love out in those places? There's nothing simple or kumbaya about that. I think he was convinced at the end of the conversation. I'm pretty sure of it. We are the preamble to love. We are the words that come together to make love real. We are all the introduction. We are the lives that demonstrate it. If anyone is going to get what love is, it's because of what we do and how we shine and how we bring that into conversations and how we turn comments toward it. We are the preamble to love. And may we always speak with eloquence, with respect, with humility, with care, with a recognition that what may be obvious to us might be new and life-changing to someone else. So may we do it, preamble love with love. Thank you.
You have been listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to www.westhill.net/donate.